the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is ever grateful to the listeners who voluntarily support this program. Today, my thanks to Margaret Anderson, Robert Donjacour, Michael McMillan, and Nancy Kilgore. If you're able and you'd like to help, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. There's a link right there that says you can help. And our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. On today's program, two powerful voices challenge the conventional wisdom about war. The passive acceptance of it, the political complacency and compromises. And we're going to do our part to offset the vacuum. In this fall's midterm election campaigns, neither Republicans nor Democrats mention war as an issue. Oh, there's a little talk about the cost. There was some peripheral debate about veterans' issues.
I had to get pushed around.
But the central matter about America's expanding wars, first in Iraq and Afghanistan, now in Yemen, expanding in Pakistan, Somalia, Sudan, and WikiLeaks has helped us understand the dimensions just a little bit. In our second segment, we're going to talk with a very interesting woman from the Chicago Theological Seminary. She's a longtime minister and peace activist, and her name is Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite. That's a difficult name, Thistlethwaite, but she has some powerful ideas that are expressed in a new book called Dreaming of Eden, American Religion and Politics in a Wired World. And even though I'm not a big promoter of Christianity and spirituality, I think it's very important to embrace voices who have a moral base in opposing the wars that we're currently enmeshed in. David Swanson is a longtime activist, going back to the Jesse Jackson days. He also worked for the group called Acorn. He was press secretary for Dennis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign. He and I first met in Washington when he organized Camp Democracy, and that would have been back in 2004. He also helped publicize the Downing Street memos with the After Downing Street website. And he's been active on many fronts. He was here in our secret studio less than a year ago talking about his book Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. And he's back today to talk about his newest book called War is a Lie. And lie is a three-letter word, just like war. David Swanson, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, Peter.
And there is a lot to talk about. And if you'll indulge me, there's one more little piece of music that I'd like to open the show with. And this came in from a listener who plays golf and records music in Las Vegas. His name is John Neims, N-E-I-M-S. You can go to his website at johnneims.com. But he sent me a CD of a song that he produced just recently over the last couple of months. And I think it's a great way to set up our conversation today.
Here we go again, asking, why are we there? Osama been forgotten, seems he's nowhere. So many satellites up in the sky. He's either invisible or he probably died. Why are we there? It is fair to ask. How long will 9/11 justify the task?
And David Swanson, one of the interesting facts I picked up from your book is that over the course of American history, we've really only been at peace about 14% of the time. And that really stunned me, because the way we think of ourselves is that we're a peaceful nation. We only go to war when absolutely necessary. Most of our wars have been valiant and righteous, according to the American storyline. Yet, in your book, you really underscore that our history is riddled with wars that were based on lies, wars that were intended to settle scores for business interests or other special interests. But we really are a warrior nation, are we not?
Oh, far and away the greatest or the worst in the history of the planet, there's no question. We do like to think that war is a last resort, and we prefer peace, and we even imagine that we proactively try to push the world in the direction of avoiding conflicts and maintaining peace and developing cooperative enterprises, and yet we just don't. And we don't have a Department of Peace. The Department of State works for the Department of Defense, which is merely the renamed Department of War.
Mm-hmm.
Our embassies, as we see in many of these leaks, spend a good deal of their time as assistant volunteer salesmen and saleswomen for American weapons companies. We end up fighting these wars against our own weapons, since it's the only thing we make anymore. We just don't put the effort in to peace, and when we do go to war, it's never the last resort. It's always something that we've chosen, and it's always the worst choice we could make.
You spilled quite a bit of ink in your book putting quotation marks around defense whenever it was used to describe the Pentagon or the secretary in charge of it, and I applaud that, David, because I think that we really need to recognize that calling it the Defense Department when we are waging preemptive acts of aggression on a large scale, that we ought to be honest about it, cut the propaganda crap, and call it the War Department. That's what it was called before, about 1950 is when the name was changed for propaganda purposes.
Yeah, 1947, the National Security Act. We got the National Security Advisor. We got the CIA. We got the Air Force. We got the Orwellian propaganda machine. We were putting in place everything we would need for the Cold War and beyond. And we haven't, of course, ended the Cold War. We've just substituted Al Qaeda for the communist threat, and it's full steam ahead. And most of what we do just has nothing to do with defending anything or anybody. And yet, for 60 years, we've been calling anything our military, and even anything most other nations' militaries do, as defense. It's just a new word we use for war making, and yet it gets into our heads, and we think it really means defending. But, you know, the funny thing is, if even two out of the hundreds of nations on the globe wanted to defend themselves in any way remotely like what the United States does, we would destroy the Earth. I mean, nobody has ever dreamed of doing this, of dividing the whole planet up into different commands, Northern Command, Central Command, Southern Command, and dominating every sphere of the geography, plus outer space, plus cyberspace. I mean, there has never been an empire like this before. And if it's defensive, then what are we to make of the fact that not a single other nation could dream of attempting anything like it? Are they all defenseless?
And David, in our second segment with the Reverend Dr. Thistlethwaite, we talk about the concept of American exceptionalism. And this is something that pervades our whole conceptualization of ourselves. And it also relates to the idea that we only fight wars of necessity. And this is a big lie. And this is something you expose in your book. And you appropriately credit Norman Solomon, our mutual friend, who published War Made Easy and really traced the history of deception leading to war in American history. But you build on that to really show the depth of this deception, and that we really have been fed a lot of propaganda about ourselves that we readily accept and rarely challenge.
Yeah, we don't tend, as a majority of the American people, barring a really intense propaganda campaign, we don't tend to want war. And when we're surveyed, we tend to say, take a lot of money out of the war machine and put it into useful things. We need jobs, for goodness sakes. You know, we aren't hell-bent on war. The opposition may be less intense in some ways than it was following World War I, leading up to World War II, when the nation was really, really against war. But, you know, we don't support wars if a lot of Americans die. The only way we support wars now is if the American deaths are minimized. But we have this militarization all around us. We can't escape it. There are bases everywhere. There are soldiers everywhere. There are weapons factories everywhere. It's the only point in our economy that's doing well, and we think that's a good thing, even though the trade-off is destroying our economy, and if we would put the money into other areas, we would save our economy. We're blind to it. We see sporting events, and they welcome the troops watching in 177 nations, and we don't ask ourselves what the hell they're doing in 177 nations. It's just part of the background and the furniture that we live with, and we don't imagine any other nation doing that, and so we think we're exceptional, and we think it really in terms that are vestiges of racism and bigotry and religious bigotry, in that we think we should occupy other people's countries for their own good, whether they want it or not, even though we, of course, would never stand for such a thing in our own country, and our first demand of any foreign occupier, regardless of their benevolent intentions, would be to get out and let us figure it out for better or worse on our own. And of course, that's what the Iraqis want of us. That's what the Afghans want of us. And yet our racist benevolence says, well, we're Americans, so we're going to stay there, whether you like it or not, for your own good until you turn into Americans like us.
And David, a moment ago, you alluded to cost considerations, that we value American lives, and implicitly we value them greater than the lives of those who we describe as our enemies. And this came into stark reality with Rumsfeld's policies in the Iraq War, where they counted but would not report both civilian and non-civilian deaths occurring at the hands of the U.S. military. And on the one hand, Americans turn a blind eye to the illegal attacks in Pakistan, where we are summarily executing people based on intelligence that has come from Pakistanis of dubious credibility. And we launch these drone strikes and blow up a house. And we're told that we, you know, have killed the number three guy in Al-Qaeda about 47 times now. And yet we know from that dramatic confrontation between a Pakistani student and Hillary Clinton just about a year ago that Pakistanis are very angry at the way we are conducting this. And the message it sends, which is to spend millions of dollars on a drone and the remote control site at the Creech Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas, and to conduct these wars like video games, we see as okay because we're protecting American lives and we don't care about the cost. The you know, cash outlay to conduct wars in this manner is something that is off the books, and that even as we're hearing all this Republican BS about deficits, war deficits don't count. And the whole accounting for wars is caught up in this convoluted sense of American exceptionalism and our own definitions of who's right and who's not.
Well, I of course, by and large, agree with all of that, although I think some of it is a little bit less true right now than it has been, and I think there's some subtlety needed. I mean, to say that I don't think American listeners to the Peter B. Collins Show turn a blind eye to these things. I think when we say Americans turn a blind eye to something, what we usually mean is that our mega cartel running these giant media outlets turn a blind eye to things, and that's certainly the case. But Americans sometimes manage to learn about things despite a blackout or a misinformation campaign in the television and newspaper cartel. And if you look at the polls, you know, while a majority of Americans wanted to go into Afghanistan when we went in initially and wanted to go into Iraq, a majority now say about both of those wars that we never should have gone in. So people do come around eventually to learning where we are, and we're learning more and more. Thanks to WikiLeaks, we see, you know, the lies about that the Pakistani government is engaged in, along with our government, about what we're doing in its nation. Same with the government in Yemen and other places. We're learning a great deal, but I will say that the United States Congress turns a blind eye to all of this. And it was stunning to watch our friend John Conyers hold yet another hearing yesterday. This is, you know, 6 years into these hearings he's been holding since he was back in the minority in 2005, exposing all of the war lies and all of the war crimes and all of the horrors and abuses. And to watch him yesterday asking the witnesses to praise him for holding yet another hearing and hearing all of the things we talk about and we're familiar with and we wish everyone were familiar with, but about which, you know, John Conyers has yet to so much as hack a website in response. And he hasn't lifted a finger to do anything in response. And I was very proud of Jeremy Scahill for saying, you know, the problem with the past 4 years of Democratic control of Congress is that you've lost the power of subpoena. You haven't enforced subpoenas on any of the criminals responsible for all of this. And John Conyers seemed completely oblivious. I'm not sure he fully remembers what the term subpoena means. And he simply wanted to be praised for hearing another hearing.
And David, you raise a very important point here. The silence of the Democrats that we elected who were so willing to confront George W. Bush over war issues and have largely gone silent since Obama took office. And I don't know if I've talked to you about this before, but I coined the concept of Leflon. If Reagan was the Teflon president, then DuPont created the new and improved Leflon for Obama so that nothing sticks when it comes from the left, and all he does is keep kissing up to the right. And we have seen, and your point about subpoena power is very important, because the forbearance that was shown, and I call it obstruction of justice, all right, but the forbearance that Democrats showed to their Republican predecessors for the obvious and now admitted war crimes that occurred, and other crimes possibly as well, this is not going to be returned by Daryl Issa and other Republicans who take the gavels in January in chairing these key House committees. There will be investigations, and it will be a very different tone than the complacency and the passivity that we've seen from the Democrats in charge since 2006.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think we go through these cycles of a Congress that abandons oversight and rubber stamps everything, which is typically what you have when the Congress is the same party as the president, whichever that party may be, and then crazy oversight of nonsense and cutthroat investigations of myths and fiction, which is what we've had with Republican Congresses and Democratic presidents. I mean, the only variation on that is sort of what we had in 2007, 2008, where you had a Democratic Congress and a Republican president, and you had the pretense of serious oversight. You had all of these hearings, all of these letters, all of these subpoenas, all of this action, and then no enforcement, no penalties, preemptive advisory that no one will be impeached no matter what they do, and dozens of high officials, including Dick Cheney, simply blowing off subpoenas. And then the past 2 years, with the Democratic Party in the White House and in the Justice Department, and the decision coming down now from a party that Congress would obey, at least up until yesterday, on all things, you didn't have a single one of those subpoenas reissued. You had no follow-through. It was pretense for 2 years. And so now, yes, we're going to go back to a Congress that looks like it wants to do oversight and might even try to enforce subpoenas, and that's going to be a very interesting fight. But it's not going to be over the serious crimes that need investigation.
We're gonna hear Tony Rezko probably come in and talk about Obama's real estate deal at the house on the south side of Chicago. I can imagine Reverend Wright is going to resurface in some sort of bizarre congressional testimony. And who knows where they'll go from there? We had Whitewater under the Clintons. Black water under the bushes. So I guess there'll be a gray water or a green water or some kind of colored water that we're going to have to investigate in depth. And while I make light of that and trivialize it, the really sad case, both morally and politically, is that the failure to, and I'm not talking about vendettas or politically driven witch hunts, but the failure to methodically evaluate, investigate, and prosecute the clear crimes that occurred under the Bush era is something that will hurt the Democrats politically and has set back our country morally even further than we thought we were.
Yeah, I can't bring myself to shed a tear over what hurts or benefits the Democrats politically, but we are destroying our republic, and it's the combination of no law enforcement for people in positions of power, at least if they're Republicans, combined with enforcement of non-existent laws against powerless people who have offended those in power. So we're likely to have more hearings on Acorn, even though Acorn's been destroyed. But Acorn was destroyed without even the allegation that it had violated any law,
right,
with an unconstitutional maneuver to go after it with a bill of attainder. We are now seeing endless loop of stories of international manhunts for Julian Assange without any pretense that there's any allegation that he's violated any law. You have a couple of random senators blurting out nonsense about the Espionage Act, seeming to fail to understand that they would first have to prosecute all the media outlets that are publishing all the material before WikiLeaks publishes it. This idea that if you're on the wrong side of power, you can be assassinated. This is public formal policy now. You can be assassinated, or you can be imprisoned without charge, or you can be tried, found innocent, and still imprisoned.
Or Nancy Grace can cover your story and convict you in half an hour. And David, we had an incident this week, and just for our listeners' benefit, you and I are talking on Friday, the 10th of December, and quite a bit has been going on. This week, the Berkeley City Council passed a resolution essentially calling for amnesty for Private Bradley Manning, who is accused of being the primary source of these WikiLeaks leaks and documents that have been released. And we were pretty clear that he was responsible for the video that started the WikiLeaks parade earlier this year. And the local radio station, the all-news station, said, yes, the Berkeley City Council has passed a resolution in support of a traitor. And they didn't call him an alleged traitor. There was none of the polite language of journalism to acknowledge that neither Bradley Manning nor Julian Assange has been formally charged with anything.
Well, Bradley Manning has been locked up and is being prosecuted, but Julian Assange, you know,
But has Manning been formally charged? I know he's been named as a suspect, and I know he's in the brig. But is there even a court martial proceeding underway?
If there is, I don't think we know what the charges are. It's speculation, and it's probably because they don't know or they don't want to get public with it. But here you're talking about someone who has allegedly released material that has exposed dozens and dozens of the most serious crimes imaginable, lies to the public and to foreign nations and to our government of the most severe quality, efforts, speaking of law enforcement's efforts, confirmed that we understood, but confirmed in this material that exposes the U.S. government going after Spain and Germany and Great Britain to prevent the enforcement of laws against our criminals, efforts to cover up wars and torture, numerous wars underway, that we ought to have a constitutional right to decide on, let alone know about, the existence of which is confirmed in these memos. I mean, this is the most valuable pile of information that has been presented to the sovereigns of our nation, the people, in many years. And the idea that there's a trade-off, even if you accept that that's good, you could claim there's a trade-off in some sort of a risk to national security. But given the fact that the material is out there without any such risk, that the Pentagon has been offered by WikiLeaks the opportunity to vet the material and has declined, that the media outlets are doing a careful vetting process and so forth, and that there's no evidence a single person has been harmed, there seems to be a strong case for letting Bradley Manning go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think he'll be seen as a hero in retrospect, but in the current context, he's certainly being demonized, and it's part of the whole firestorm. And David, this leads to a whole area of war and secrecy and the lies that are told. And of course, this we get into a bit of a conundrum here because I don't embrace war conceptually, but I can rationally understand the people who do and the concepts that they use to embrace it. And therefore, I do understand intellectually that waging a war against an enemy requires a level of stealth and secrecy and surprise and all of those things. But what we have seen, particularly since the advent of the Cold War, is what the late Chalmers Johnson, and we'll pause here a moment just to remember Professor Johnson, who passed away a couple of weeks ago, and his courageous work as a former intelligence person himself, or at least aligned with the intelligence community. He very courageously came out and coined the term blowback and wrote the trilogy of books that really expose the history of American military expansionism, the imperialism, economic imperialism that drives it, and the whole concept that the secrecy that we engaged in the last war rolls forward and leaves us both vulnerable to various liabilities, and also, once you start lying, you have to keep lying. And so WikiLeaks really has pulled back the lid on at least the recent history of this war-based deception. And it is a very, very dangerous virus to any society that has a pretense of democracy.
Absolutely. And, you know, most of I don't think we should wait until the future for Bradley Manning to be considered a hero. I mean, most of us who care about peace and justice consider him a hero. I don't know that the corporate media and the writers of history books will ever get it right unless we have significant changes in our culture and our society. But this has exposed U.S. participation in military coups in places like Honduras, has exposed dialogue with people like the King of Saudi Arabia urging us on to more aggressive illegal war against Iran, has exposed that our embassy in Norway, even leading up to the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, lived and breathed, in their words, their role as salesman for Lockheed Martin to the nation they are there dialoguing with. I mean, it's just endless dozens and dozens of stories exposed in this material, and yet all we hear about is the evil of the people who've let us know about it,
right,
and gossip about it, without much information on the substantive material itself.
Yeah. Well, and it is amazing to see all of the hysterical reaction. I mean, Joe Lieberman has been leading the charge for the call anyway, to lock up Julian Assange. But it's not clear that we have a basis to do that. And this is one of the things that has really changed since 9/11, where people don't consider process. They kind of accept that the end justifies the means, even if it's unconstitutional, illegal, immoral, or even doesn't square with the facts. People are not interested in those petty details. They simply see a monster on their television screen, and they immediately knee-jerk to say, well, lock him up and send him to Gitmo and torture him.
Right. Here's someone who supposedly slept with two different women when he was in Sweden without having been married to either one of them, and read stories about himself in the car on his BlackBerry, and forgot to call one of them, and had a condom break. And, you know, these are like the sort of things we were told about Manuel Noriega when we had a desperate need to bomb Panama. You know, he wore red pajamas and he did drugs and he slept with prostitutes and so forth, which, you know, may or may not be relevant to your judgment of someone's moral character, but isn't really a serious reason for bombing thousands of people and blowing their limbs off and leaving their family members bleeding to death in front of them. It just doesn't seem to measure up. And yet we're so often given, whether it's in the case of someone who needs to be prosecuted or, as some are calling for, shot, or a need for a war, we're given a single individual who's demonized and characterized, and we're told about their human rights abuses, whether it's in Iran or North Korea, even though those evils, to the extent that they're true, excuse me, do not threaten our nation in any way. So we have to have the argument about defensive wars on top of that, and in many times contradicting that. And then the arguments for the benefit to the people that we're going to bomb, and our spreading of democracy and our humanitarian wars. And all of these reasons are piled one on top of another, and some appeal to certain populations and some to others, until you get enough cumulatively to support a war. But all of them individually are false, as well as in combination.
Well, David, you just set me up for where I wanted to go next, which is Chapter 3 of your book called War is a Lie. And the chapter is entitled Wars Are Not Waged Out of Generosity. And you pull a couple of quotes from Colin Powell and George W. Bush. Powell, we will not abandon the Iraqi people. Bush, the United States will not abandon Iraq. And then you talk back to them. You write, if I break into your house, smash the windows, bust up the furniture, and kill half your family, do I have a moral obligation to stay and spend the night? Would it be cruel and irresponsible for me to abandon you, even when you encourage me to leave? Or is it my duty, on the contrary, to depart immediately and turn myself in at the nearest police station? Once the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq had begun, a debate began that resembled this one. As you can see, these two approaches are many miles apart, despite both being framed as humanitarian. One says that we have to stay out of generosity. The other says we have to leave out of shame and respect. And this is something that's bubbling under in what little debate there is about the U.S. expansion in Afghanistan, David. And that is the argument that if we leave, the Taliban will be rolling back the rights of women. And there's no question that under, you know, the draconian laws that require burqas and keep girls out of school, that there are many measures that were imposed by the Taliban during the 90s that are reprehensible and counter to the human rights of females. But to advance that as the reason that we should stay in what is clearly a losing occupation and effort to pacify this nation is irrational, but it does gain traction when it's presented in our media by certain people.
Well, there are two ways in which this is a lie. The first lie is the pretense that our government actually gives a damn about any such thing. You know, we do not go and fight our wars based on where women's rights are most abused in the world. We pick these excuses for the wars that we want to have for very different motivations. But I don't mean we, I mean our government. But even accepting that, you could still make the case that, well, they may be fighting it for power and glory and gas pipelines and bases and profits, but it's still the case that we have to stay there for women's rights, and that's false as well. We are not defending women's rights. Women are not better off now. They don't have prospects of becoming better off. And when you contrast, you know, better and worse rights in the workplace and schools and public spaces and so forth, you can't leave out the right to live, the right not to be blown to pieces, the right not to have your door kicked in by the United States military at night and your family slaughtered. I mean, these are very significant rights as well. And the destruction that our occupation is doing to the whole society makes it harder and harder for serious and durable rights to be put in place. The Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan maintains that the longer the occupation lasts, the worse the post-occupation period will be. And this is a group established and working for women's rights. And it's made up of women who live in Afghanistan, who ought to have some say in such matters. We ought not to just turn to Brzezinski and Biden and such white male Americans to find out what's good for Afghan women.
So how do we counter that? Because it's used to appeal in an emotional way to people who don't pay, you know, attention to the full range of complex issues. It's used to distract and distort. And this creates a problem for people who want to see the U.S. get out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. And there isn't even anything. Obama's promise to bring some troops home next summer doesn't mean anything to me. So I don't believe that we're on track to begin pulling significant numbers out for several years, if that. And yet, you know, I see this as an argument that is going to resurface every time any momentum develops behind a U.S. withdrawal.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think this is an argument that could ever win a majority of Americans. I think it's a secondary argument. I think if we could get rid of all of the the drive for revenge and vengeance and the racism and the sadism and among the real war planners, the profit motives and the power motives and so forth, then I don't think these humanitarian pretenses would drive the wars or even keep them in place. But they are one of the stronger motivations in propaganda terms that are part of the package that keep it going. But I think people have to understand that if they're going to accept on faith that because your government says, among other things, that we have to stay in Afghanistan for the good of Afghan women, if you're going to accept that on faith, then that's a recipe for permanently staying in Afghanistan. So you have to actually look at the facts, at whether we are benefiting the women of Afghanistan and whether it's worth the price. We make all of these calculations about the good that wars do, but we never draw up the balance sheet and put the negative beside it and see whether it's worth it or not. So you have to look at how many people we're killing, how many people we're traumatizing, what we're doing to the environment and the economy and so forth, and then ask yourself whether the prospect that we might someday improve things for Afghan women outweighs all of that. And then if you're going to talk so endlessly about democracy and democratic freedoms and rights, then you have to figure out a way to square that with the fact that the people of Afghanistan want us out and want the war over, and we're insisting on staying for their own good despite them. And I think that's a very, very difficult case to make.
And David, I just pulled up your new website, warisacrime.org, and on the homepage you have an article posted written by Kathy Kelly. And this is just a couple of sentences, a quick quote. In Afghanistan, a nation where 850 children die every day and about a quarter of the population goes hungry, the UN says that 7.4 million Afghans live with hunger and fear of starvation, while millions more rely on food help, and one in five children die before the age of five. Now, you know, it's very hard to compare misery, but this is an immediate problem that could be addressed by the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan in a prompt way. And while we are, you know, we now claim that we have pacified the town of Marja, which we thought would take about a month, and we're now claiming some sort of victory 7 or 8 months later, the effort that we have put in, it just seems to be counterproductive to any humanitarian purpose, and that ultimately, by allowing conditions in Afghanistan to be as dire as they are for the average person, and with child mortality at such a high rate, you can't win hearts and minds no matter what you do when you permit those kinds of conditions to continue.
Well, that's right. It's absolutely hopeless on its own terms. We see in the WikiLeaks cables the European nations expressing their understanding that it's hopeless and pointless on its own terms, but their willingness to keep going out of deference to the United States, sort of as Congress keeps the wars going out of deference to whoever's in the White House. Everybody in the White House and in the Pentagon understands as well, just as they understood with Vietnam for years and kept it going, that it's hopeless, that it's a question of how much blood, how much treasure before we pull out. And they can't help themselves. They can't resist the prospects, not just for a gas pipeline, but for bases and weapons and nuclear weapons in this strategic spot in Asia. And it's very hard for them politically to understand that it's to their benefit to pull out. I think Obama is on a Lyndon B. Johnson political trajectory where he's going to destroy his political career over his fear of destroying his political career by doing the right thing. And you'd think that if we're going to talk about democracy and women's rights while having nothing to show for it, we would also care about death and destruction and starvation Kathy has spent quite some time over there with families in Afghanistan, seen what life is like for them, and understands that their top concerns are for the drones to stop buzzing overhead, the doors to stop being kicked in at night, and to have food to eat. These are pressing demands. I think you're right that the U.S. could play a role in solving these problems quite easily if that's what we wanted to do. I don't think the military is the right tool for it. I don't think the military is set up for humanitarian relief efforts, and I think that we use it for such efforts because it allows us to get the military into new parts of the world.
Well, Norman Solomon has frequently reminded me, David, that Barack Obama, shortly after he became president, authorized his first increase of troop levels in Afghanistan, about 30,000. And at that time, he said that he wanted to have a humanitarian to military ratio of 80-20, 80% humanitarian, 20% military. Now, that spoke of and I even think he used the term surge, a major spike in our spending on so-called nation building, which is widely derided, and on simply humanitarian aid. And yet the proportions were really flipped, where what we have seen is an increased investment in military and really very little follow through on the humanitarian or social level.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that proportion of 80 to 20, 80 civilian, 20 military, is in the counterterrorism manual that General Petraeus supposedly wrote. And yet I don't think that the civilian efforts, the quote-unquote non-military civilian efforts of our government in Afghanistan have ever gotten above 5% of the spending. And when you talk to Richard Holbrooke, who heads up those so-called civilian efforts, he continually talks about his job as supporting the military and assisting the military. Just as the State Department, as exposed by WikiLeaks, sees itself and in fact takes orders from the CIA and the Pentagon, that's what our so-called civilian effort in Afghanistan does as well. It's not that there isn't some logic to the counterterrorism plan in these manuals, and the idea that you could somehow try to win hearts and minds while engaging in a hostile occupation of somebody's country. It's just that, implausible as that is, we've never even come close to trying it. We talk about it and do the exact opposite, which is, of course, even less productive.
David, one of the other themes that runs through your book, and you do have a chapter devoted to it, is the corporate media, what you referred to as the media cartel in this country. And when we look back somewhat nostalgically now at the Pentagon Papers, Dan Ellsberg, and the way in which the intersection of his courage and the courage of those who ran the New York Times and the Washington Post in particular, in challenging the Nixon administration regarding the release of the Pentagon Papers, we don't have anything remotely close to that in our media today. Now, while the New York Times did partner in releasing some of the WikiLeaks documents, and I'll give them partial credit for that, you remind us in your book about the way they sat on the NSA's illegal wiretapping story for a full year. And they could have released it in time to have an impact on the 2004 stolen re-election of George W. Bush. And so we really do have to see the mainstream media in this country as complicit in the deception that props up our wars and the war economy. And it's I don't want to toot my own horn, but it is alternative media. And people like you who are active and write books and get out, and we'll talk about your tour stops here coming up in a moment. But it's really important that people who are listening to this understand that we are so outweighed and outnumbered by the right wing and corporate media in this country, and that people need to take the initiative to get their information from other sources and to be proactive in that, because Otherwise, we are simply passively accepting the obvious propaganda that is manufactured for us.
That's absolutely right. I agree 100%, and I'd be glad to toot your horn. I think that shows like this are what's keeping us together, and people need to support them and promote them and listen to them and make more of them. There's nothing easier to do, nothing more efficient to do. It's 100% gain when you invest in producing good media that reports the news and opens up the airwaves to more viewpoints. It's very different from, you know, betting the farm on one lousy political candidate who might be a little bit better than the other lousy political candidate, and 90% of that money being channeled into the corporate media for stupid advertisements that make us all meaner and degrade our dialogue. I think independent media is the easiest solution to one of, if not the single biggest problem with our society, the lack of a good communication system.
Yeah. Well, we have to be vigilant. And the other thing before we wrap up, David, I just wanted to ask you for your generalized impression. If we acknowledge that George W. Bush was the guy who lied us into war and kept lying to us, is Obama any different in your view? Is he slightly better? Are there nuances? What's your viewpoint there?
Well, he's not better morally or legally. He's continuing the crimes, and he's working very hard to immunize from any sort of penalty his predecessors for their crimes, which is, of course, in his interest as he continues them. He doesn't want the precedent of his predecessors being prosecuted. He is expanding on the abuses of his predecessor, just as every previous president has done, but he has much more to work with here. And you know, he's taking us further down the road toward militarism, toward a militarized economy, toward ever expanding presidential powers. The new Republican Congress will probably give him a new authorization to use military force without any connection to 9/11, with the explicit presidential right to throw out laws and civil rights. I think it's a very, very dangerous path. And because Barack Obama is further down that road than Bush, he's taking us even further. You'd have to argue that he's worse, which, you know, doesn't mean he would have been worse if he'd been put in office in 2000, but he's worse now. And at the same time, our resistance has been defunded and demobilized because everybody thought somehow that he would be better. And the whole conversation around which direction a president is going to take us and the all-importance of presidents itself illustrates the damage that has been done, in that we don't think of Congress or the states or the people as responsible and in power here. We focus on these presidents.
Yeah. Well, David, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I thank you for continuing your activism and fighting for the interests that we share. The new book is called War is a Lie, and you can get it for half price if you go to the website warisacrime.org. That's warisacrime.org. And what other outlets carry the book, David?
Well, I'm boycotting Amazon, which has answered the government's request and gone after WikiLeaks.
Uh-huh.
But you can get it there if you want to, or any other bookseller or independent bookstores. But you can go to warisacrime.org or warisalie.org, and you can get it cheap, and you can get it in audiobooks and ebooks and Kindle books and PDFs and so forth. And the book tour schedule is there too. And I'll be in your general part of the country. I'll be in Berkeley on the 17th.
Yeah, let's run it down. Berkeley the 17th, San Jose the 18th, Santa Cruz on the 18th, L.A. on the 19th, and then starting in the new year in New York on January 4th, Baltimore on the 10th. And then in your backyard there in Washington, D.C. on the 18th of January. All the details at warisalie.org or warisacrime.org. We've been talking with David Swanson. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Peter.
And the Peter B. Collins Show continues. Cinema Classics is one of our sponsors, the movie company that specializes in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Just click on the link at peterbcollins.com. We'll get you free shipping on any order, too. Just enter PBC in the comments section of their website order form. Joining us now is the Reverend Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite. And Thistlethwaite is a tongue twister, but I live next door to the Cowperthwaites, so I've had a little practice. She is the former president of the Chicago Theological Seminary, where she continues to serve as a professor. She's also a senior fellow at the left-leaning Center for American Progress, based in Washington, D.C. And she's been an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ since 1974, author or editor of 7 books. And the most recent is Dreaming of Eden, subtitled American Religion and Politics in a Wired World. Dr. Thistlethwaite, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you for having me, Peter.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and you raise some provocative ideas in your book. I want to start a little bit deeper in, and let me just read a passage here, and we'll start a conversation. You say, the reason religion is on the rise around the world is that people are disoriented by modern life. It's too much, it's too fast, and it's contradictory. The whole world lives in the digital age. After the election protests in Iran, no one can doubt that not only the United States, but everywhere, people are wired, connected, and at the same time experiencing the huge disconnections that the digital age imposes and even magnifies. And you go on to say, we will not get wiser about national security without recognizing that the digital age is the human fall from innocence delivered at terabyte speed. But human beings constantly dream of Eden, and so they are attracted to religions that offer a simple and fixed promise of the return to innocence. The greatest security threat we face in the world is from the rise of conservative religions that promise an escape to Eden or heaven or a version of paradise. And these religions are on the rise. Well, there, Dr. Thistlethwaite, I really strongly agree with you that fundamentalist religions, including Christian ones, really are taking us in very dangerous directions.
Well, you know, I agree with it, too, and I wrote it. but, I think someone could read that and think, well, you know, this person's not very religious. And I'm an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ. As you said, I've been a minister for more than 30 years. And I really do think there's a difference between the kind of drive for certainty and, you know, everything important that happens to you in religion happens after you're dead. These kinds of ideas make people discount the world we live in. And this is the creation. God made this world and gave it to us as a gift. And so we need to take this world seriously, and we need to find meaning in this world. So I want to also convey that I think religion also contains within itself some of the answers, and I'm trying to explore those answers in the book. But when people, you know, are going to tell you, well, you know, go ahead and set off this bomb because everything's going to be fine for you in heaven after you're dead, you know, that turns out to be very, very dangerous. But also, you know, the idea of we don't need to protect the planet because the rapture's coming and, you know, you could be lifted up out of your socks at any minute. So we don't have to be concerned about this pollution or using coal.
Right.
I think there's, as in all things, there's, you know, more than one way to look at it. But I'm trying to look at it from how does religion help us find meaning right here and not just tell us, well, everything will be solved after you die and go to heaven. I trust that, you know, the God that I believe in won't abandon me after death, but I also believe that this world is good, as it says in Genesis, and that we are to take care of it.
And there are two things I'd like to bounce off there. One is your final statement there, which I think defines a worldview that's very different from many fundamentalist Christians, and that is that human beings are fundamentally good and decent and want to do good things, want to do the right thing. And I think that's an important point of departure, because since 9/11, our country has demonized the Islamic world. And while certain leaders try to say we're not at war with Islam, the overwhelming media message and the religious message from the hardline Christian groups in this country is that we are at war with Islam. Mm. And I get regular emails from right-wing Christian groups who think that Sharia law is creeping into our system here in the United States, and who really play up the boogeyman aspect of Americans' ignorance of Islam. And so we've got to start with the human beings who consider themselves people of faith, but they promote that faith in ways that are often contradictory to the values they claim to hold and espouse, and often very dangerous in the way that they're implemented.
Yes, and, you know, I do think that as a person of faith, people have a capacity to be good, not perfect, but good, and I have a section in the book on goodness, but also people have the capacity to do incredibly cruel and violent and destructive things to one another. And I see the age of the Internet as, you know, drawing out a great deal of human creativity, but also accelerating the capacity to do harm. And this is a perfect kind of Internet firestorm, this creation of Islamophobia. And I, not in this book, but subsequently in a column I write for the Washington Post, I said, well, this is McCarthyism. You know, this is the way McCarthy started, as sort of, you know, here's an alien, and here's an alien, and here's an alien, and all of a sudden everybody's an alien. Well, you know, a lot of the Muslim Americans I know actually are just as afraid of, perhaps in some ways even more so, afraid of these violent extremists, not only because they're literally dangerous in terms of what they might do to us, but also because they're hijacking their religion and making it, saying that Islam is about things that plainly the Quran does not say it is about. So I think that, you know, all you say, all the emails that you get, well, a good deal of this Islamophobia happens in this wired world, this accelerated blogosphere where, mm-hmm. you know, the most believable exaggerations get out there and start getting forwarded, and pretty much everybody thinks they're fact. And it really hardens the discussion. It makes people very, very aggressive towards one another. I think it's a, you know, it's not just a medium that we can say, well, this is exactly the way we've always been, and then we've got this big megaphone, the Internet, that's doing this. I actually think it's also bringing out some aspects of human nature, both creativity and goodness, and also capacity for cruelty and violence, and we need to think about it in religious terms.
Well, and Dr. Thistlethwaite, my view is that this is being used many times to obscure the shortcomings of Christianity, and particularly the American versions of it, and that instead of any kind of careful self-examination of the role that we have played in fomenting those who are aligned against us, whether we talk about Al-Qaeda or other groups that we have taken on, we have this sense of American exceptionalism, that this is a nation that has God, you know, his winds are in our sails, and he's always beaming down, and every president ends every public statement with God bless America. And this point of exceptionalism is heavily promoted by Sarah Palin, who I regard as appealing to the darker and ignorant aspects of the American body politic. But this is a very serious problem in my view, because we promote this sense that everything the United States does is righteous and right. And we're on the wrong side of a lot of issues right now, whether it's torture and unlimited detention at Guantanamo and Bagram and other points around the world, illegal, immoral wars that we conduct without even any debate in this fall's midterm election campaigns. The wars were off the charts when just 2 years ago they were the central points of our political debate.
Well, you know, since you read the chapter on war and torture in my book, I think you are making the same connections I do, that this kind of cheap and lazy view of American exceptionalism, which is God loves us best, and, you know, it doesn't really matter what we do because God just really is going to be on our side. So we can go over there and we can attack a country that's not attacked us, and we can make up some weapons of mass destruction and try to convince the American people that's a good reason to do that. We can engage in torture and then in this convoluted rhetoric say, oh, no, no, it's not torture, but it's plainly torture, and then feel justified in doing it. So that's a lazy view of the doctrine of providence where, you know, it's just like God just likes us, and, you know, no matter what we do, God likes us. And it also, I think, makes us less safe, and I would say this to Sarah Palin or anyone else, because what keeps us safer, nobody can be absolutely safe, but what keeps us safer is actually we do have some pretty good values. You know, we have freedom of religion. We have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. This Constitution, that it's a big advance in the history of human civilization. And when we live up to those values, you know, we're a little more exceptional. But when we don't, people around the world go, you're not exceptional, you're hypocrites. And so it makes us less safe. And the best thing we can do is not only promote these values, but actually act up to them. And so, and when we do, then somebody might say, well, you know, you're partnering with God there to improve the world. That's a good thing, and I want to be your partner as well. And if a person is not a religious person, say, well, my humanist values also connect with that, and so I can connect with that. But, you know, the Palin perspective, in my view, is just incredibly superficial, and I think actually ends up reducing our capacity as Americans to promote national security and puts us more at risk, which is a big problem.
Dr. Thistlethwaite, I just want, for your information, to let you know, I describe myself as a recovering Catholic. I'm somewhere over in the agnostic zone. I believe Jesus Christ was a great human being who left us with a blueprint and a philosophy that whether you think he was the Messiah or not is valuable. My problem is with the earthly promoters of religion. And let me just take one aspect of it that we touched on a moment ago, our torture policies and the detention policies. These are inhumane, they are inhuman, they're absolutely immoral, and they happen to be illegal, both under American law and the treaties that we are parties to.
Mm-hmm.
And my complaint is that the religious leaders in the United States have not spoken up in any coordinated or consistent way about these gross violations of our own moral standards. And that there was similar silence when a Christian named Bush led us into war on faulty pretenses in Iraq. And we now see people silent to supportive of President Obama's expansion of the war in Afghanistan and the expansion of the use of these unmanned drones, which are summarily executing people who we've never had contact with on the ground in Pakistan and Yemen. And yet we see the religious leaders in the United States, and I'm not trying to lump you in with the Catholic bishops or with any evangelicals, but there is much more interest in the issues of same-sex marriage and abortion rights than there is in what I think are the greatest moral issues of our time, which relate to war, to torture, and detention.
Well, I would encourage you to go to religiouscoalitionagainstwar.org. Richard Kilmer, the executive director, we're a group of religious leaders who do speak out against torture all the time. The day after Abu Ghraib, I published an editorial in the Chicago Tribune that just went viral called Can a Nation Lose Its Soul? And they published it alongside the picture of the man who was hooded and was standing on the box,
mm-hmm.
with the wires attached to him. And, of course, he had been told that he was going to be electrocuted if he stepped off the box. I've written repeatedly on this. I've stood many demonstrations on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House. It's a large coalition of religious leaders who are unambiguous about the fact that torture is wrong. It's always wrong. It is a shame and a crime that our nation has engaged in this in any way. We, the United States, were trusted with the original documents of the Geneva Conventions because people felt, well, surely the United States will be a safe place to keep the original documents. And I, you know, if you read my book, you know I go on about this at length there, mm-hmm. but I think people who are listening to your show would be interested to join us in the Religious Coalition Against Torture. And you can get for your church, synagogue, mosque, whatever religious organization you are, or institution, you can get a giant banner from us. Torture is wrong, and you may have seen these driving around. That comes from the Religious Coalition Against Torture. So there are a lot of people who are very active about this, even up to and including commenting on President Bush's memoir and his
admissions of guilt
that he ordered the torture of Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. And so there were some excellent pieces published in the Huffington Post about this by religious leaders, including evangelicals. So there is actually quite a lot of religious activity against this, and we are happy to have anybody join us. There's absolutely no cost to helping out with this campaign.
And how do you view President Obama on these issues?
Again, in the book, I have said I don't think this is something that we can just move past, which is what President Obama has said. I think it's been a terrible mistake not to hold people accountable in the previous administration to actually investigate not only the functionaries at the mid-level, the lawyers. And, you know, after Nuremberg, you think it's okay to say, well, the lawyers thought it was fine. You know, really? Really? So I know, I totally disagree with that. I thought the administration should have come in and immediately, and you know, I know that the economy was tanking. I mean, I know that. Everybody knows that. But I do think that taking care of the moral health of the country is as important as bailing out GM.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thistlethwaite, I want to play an excerpt of a song for you here. And this was written by a British group in the late 1980s. And their name is The. That's just The twice.
Mm-hmm.
And the song is called Armageddon Days Are Here Again. And I'd just like you to listen to a little of it and then get your comment on it.
That Jesus Christ is coming, honey, you've got another thing coming. If he ever finds out who's hijacked his name, they'll cut out his heart and turn in his grave. His lamp is rising, the Christians mobilize.
Islam is rising, the song says, the whole world mobilizing. And what George W. Bush did, in my view, Dr. Thistlethwaite, was fulfill the wildest ambitions of Osama bin Laden to deploy American...
Yes, I so agree with you. My goodness.
To deploy American troops on Islamic soil long term. And we don't get it. And in your book, you talk about the need to embrace soft power. And we've used a lot of hard power, massive military might, tons and tons of bombs. And we've destroyed lots of property and killed a lot of people. But we don't understand fundamentally that we have engaged in a religious war, or at least that's how it's viewed by many of our adversaries. But we're not doing anything in significant ways to diminish that perception or to change the reality.
Well, I've been a member of the peace movement since I was a college student and went on my first hunger strike when then President Nixon was attempting to widen the Vietnam War into Cambodia. And in the peace movement, we say, when you mirror your enemy, you become your enemy. And so, you know, this is really a case of an enemy theology finding an enemy theology on the other side. And people who hold these views actually can't do what they want to do unless they've got an enemy, right? Because you can't have, you know, can say, well, you're Satan. No, you're Satan. And, you know, so it escalates, and it's, you know, these enemies are necessary for each other. And, of course, this is not the first conflict in which that's the case. So trying to move beyond enemy stereotyping is one way to reduce conflict. And, of course, finding common ground, finding common values, and being able to work together at a kind of pragmatic level is one way to reduce that conflict. You don't eliminate conflict. And people say, well, they say, have you ended war yet? In a pejorative way. Mm-hmm. Any life you save, any conflict you prevent, any killing you prevent through peace activism is a net value. And it doesn't mean every bit of work that people do on this. And all day long, all around the world, there are a lot of dedicated people working to try to reduce conflict in their communities, build common ground. And, they don't get reported on a whole lot, but one of the things that people who do radio shows like you can do is report on those things from these communities. And I think that's a fantastic thing.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, you also write about economic justice in a number of chapters in the book, and we have just witnessed one of the greatest thefts of the average person's wealth in recent history, certainly in my lifetime. And while the right wing in this country decried any efforts to discuss this as class warfare, they waged it and won it. And we have seen a massive transfer of wealth from the middle class to the top 2% in this country. And this is now a worldwide phenomenon, and we've seen that citizens in Greece, in France, in Portugal, in Spain, and now Ireland have taken to the streets and mostly in nonviolent ways. Occasionally it has strayed into some violent behavior. But they've been speaking up and attempting to stop their governments from essentially cementing this massive theft of our wealth and our rights, our economic rights to pensions and to retirement security. And yet in the United States, people seem more concerned about who the contestants are going to be on American Idol than they are about what has happened here to our economy. And while Democrats are now starting to push back against President Obama's recent deal with the Republicans regarding the extension of Bush tax cuts, that's not the whole story or the full picture about economic justice in this country.
No. Well, I write about Cain and Abel as mankers, you know, and this is the biblical Cain who kills Abel and then goes and founds the first city. And Enoch, east of Eden. And I talk about Cain and make a play on words of Keynesian economics. There's a whole lot of greed that motivates what you're talking about. And, Jesus went to the bank in Israel, which is the temple, and he overturned the tables. And that's often told as a very religious story, but it's an economic story. What were the people doing in the temple that Jesus was so upset about? Well, what they were doing is pilgrims would come to the temple, and the bankers there, of course, it's a religious bank, a treasury, but the bankers there would exchange their foreign currency for the currency that only the temple would accept, the local currency, at very, very unfavorable exchange rates. And it's just a story about Jesus being upset about bankers ripping people off. And the first thing that introduces this story is Jesus goes down and he sits down opposite the treasury where he could see the money box. And I've written on this so often, as Jesus said, watch the money. And what people do with their money, I don't care what faith or of humanist values you are, you want to know what people really believe, you watch what happens to the money. And that's true in Congress, it's true in the administration, and it's true in your neighborhood, in your state, in your local government. And that's very often not preached because, you know, people shy away from drawing the connections between what happened there when Jesus overturned the tables. But think about how much, you know, it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than a rich man to get into heaven. I mean, Jesus really rather pointed about the rich exploiting the poor. And we need, as religious leaders, to emphasize this, but I'll tell you, I mean, it isn't popular for people to do that. But I think you must, because, you know, I argue in the book that Brazil is becoming our economic model, right? Doug Copeland's image of Brazilification in his novels. That's not the past. That's not under development. For many people, that's the future. That's a few mega wealthy people controlling the government, controlling the finances. And, you know, I think one of the most immoral decisions, I mean, Dred Scott certainly would be one, but Citizens United by the Supreme Court.
That's right.
That's completely immoral. Yeah. And to say that a corporation is a human being, does a corporation bleed? Does a corporation have a conscience? Does a corporation have a soul? No, it doesn't. And so I think that that's an ill-considered, really kind of theft of democracy decision. I mourn that. I mourn that Supreme Court decision, and I've written about it. This is, you know, not even to just have all this money in the public square, but to have secret money.
Yeah.
So you can't even tell where the money's coming from. You can't even fight the people who are fighting against you, because you don't know who they are.
Well, so, we know enough that the undisclosed donors to Karl Rove and to the Chamber of Commerce are the very billionaires who have benefited most from this huge transfer of wealth, theft in many cases, and they manage to disguise it often through these phony grassroots so-called Tea Party activists.
Mm-hmm.
And the media has hyped that up and amped it up into a movement when, in fact, it's a handful of people who are largely responding to the needs and demands of the wealthiest plutocrats in this country.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And, we've got a word for this in Christianity. We call it sin. And so, I think that's sinful to, in effect, structure a society so that people are systematically prevented from having the means to live, having the means to feed their families, to have a decent roof over their head, to just have some health care. And, you know, is this that hard? Is it really that hard to think that this is a moral value? It's one of the arguments in my book that we've got to really take back progressive religion and be able to articulate it in the public square. And I'll be self-critical about this, all right? I'm a professor of theology, an academic institution. This is the first book I've ever written for a public audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad on my part. I should have all along been trying to write in such a way that, you know, is Rick Warren the only person who can write public audience books and say, you know, well, here's, you know, a purpose-driven life? And I'm saying, no, that's not the purpose-driven life. Here's your neighbor, and that's when you find purpose. And so, you know, I made a decision because I really felt things had gotten so bad that I was going to try to just put our values in plain, ordinary English and put them out there and talk to people like you on the radio to try to figure out a way that we can say, look, you know, you've hijacked Christianity.
Well, right? And I'm glad you did, and I hope that people will go to their bookstore and find you, hopefully in the same section as, say, Jim Wallace or, some of the other people who are trying to promote progressive values in the religious sphere. Let me quote here. Your book is called Dreaming of Eden, and you write, "Yes, we are not in the Garden of Eden anymore, but that's not the bad news, religiously speaking. We need to know that we are not innocent, but we also need to know that we're not just damned sinners either." I guess that's damned sinners.
I wasn't swearing. I meant damnation.
Okay. I think I used the Reverend Wright inflection there. I apologize. But you go on. Before we reconstruct the Garden of Eden story of the fall from innocence in a way that can actually help us, we should look at another concrete example of when innocence becomes dangerous. And this is about the illusion that financial markets are innocent. This idea works especially well in a market economy like we have here in the U.S. Translated into economic language for the good people, greed is good, regulation is bad. And the bad people are really just getting what they deserve in terms of lost jobs or foreclosed homes. And you connect it to the rapturists, Tim LaHaye and his ilk. You say that when they write books called Left Behind, one of the things they really mean is that in this world, the poor people and the unsaved middle class get left behind. That's the dollars and cents version of the rapture. The conservative religious idea that there are innocent people and guilty people is alive and well in the efforts to blame the economic meltdown on the poor and middle class. That's a very powerful statement.
Well, you know, I read that Left Behind novel, and you got to read what the other side is saying. And I thought, you don't mean in heaven. You just got to realize these people are actually telling you what they think. They think if you're not saved, you can be left behind right now. And they do. And so it's not my Christianity. Sorry. And I think that it wasn't the Christianity of Jesus. It wasn't the Christianity of the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm just trying to say it in as plain a way as I can, and say it as often as I can, because we're on the verge of a real crisis. Because you get this juggernaut of the consolidation of wealth too far down the road, and you can't even get into the if people these corporate interests own the media, then how are you going to get the word out for people to form a genuine populist movement? Yeah, there's an AstroTurf movement, the Tea Party, but genuine populism comes from the fact that people need to know this is not American values, and that we can fight back against this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doctor, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for jumping out into the public arena, and I hope that a lot of people will read your book and respond to your ideas.
Well, thank you very much. This is a wonderful conversation. I greatly enjoyed it.
Well, good. My pleasure as well. Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, the author of Dreaming of Eden, subtitled American Religion and Politics in a Wired World. It's out in hardcover from Palgrave Macmillan. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Drop me an email, fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until